The World is supported in part by listeners like you, and for a limited time, if you join them and make a gift to The World, your donation will be matched. That means double the support for our in-depth coverage of the day's top stories, brought to you with context, perspective, and heart. Donate today at theworld.org/match, and thanks. Maybe you're on the road right now, driving to your Thanksgiving gathering with family and friends. For soldiers deployed abroad, Thanksgiving can be a time to create new traditions.
I commented about it to our interpreter. I said, hey, Haitham, we have this thing called Thanksgiving, and it's this big celebration. It's kind of on the scale of one of the Ramadan meals. Is there a way that we can buy a couple turkeys from the locals here?
Also today, Germany's far-right AfD party asked an opera house for a list of the nationalities of its performers. This director finds that chilling.
Doing lists in Germany, you get goosebumps because you are remembered in the Third Reich. Yeah? Lists of Jewish people and Jewish shops.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. Tomorrow is a federal holiday. Today almost is. Call it our National Day of Travel. So you're excused if you have not been actively tracking our top story today. Malta, the island nation south of Sicily, is in turmoil over a mysterious murder. Three senior figures in the Maltese government have stepped down, including the Prime Minister's chief of staff. Keith Schembri was taken into police headquarters for questioning. It's all to do with the death of investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. She died in October of 2017 in a car bombing, and for the people of Malta, the mystery around that has not disappeared. Before Caruana Galizia was killed, she'd been working on a story about government corruption implicating the Prime Minister's chief of staff. Corinne Vella is the sister of Daphne Caruana Galizia, and she joins us now from Malta. There seems to be a growing momentum around the investigation into your sister's death. What has given you the most hope recently?
The fact that something is happening at all, the fact that there are arrests is long overdue. The last arrests were in December 2017. So for a long time, it seemed like nothing much was happening. It's not the end yet, and there's no end in sight. But we are hopeful that things may just now start to change.
What do you believe these resignations of these officials and these arrests will reveal in terms of evidence that could lead to the prosecution of the people who ordered and planted this bomb in your sister's car?
Given that there's so much information flowing, you know, it's been a very long week and things have shifted a lot. But what we're certain of is Daphne's murder was related to her work. And none of the three men who were accused of having put the bomb in her car were anybody she actually wrote about herself. So very definitely other people were involved. Now, with the new arrests, you know, the thread of what might have happened is becoming clearer. And now with the recent information about the Prime Minister's chief of staff being arrested and interrogated as a murder suspect, it seems like those two strands are coming together.
So Maltese businessman Jorgen Fennec is the owner of the infamous 17 Black. That's
yes.
A secret company listed as a target client of two offshore Panamanian companies owned by the Prime Minister's chief of staff and Minister Konrad Mitzi. It's very complicated, but what do you believe is the link between the revelation of the Panama Papers, and a story that your sister had been working assiduously on, and your sister's death?
The only connection between Jorgen Fennec and these two men is, as you said, 17 Black. That's a company Daphne had first mentioned, but she had never really had the time to go into and have written about again. But naturally, the people who are involved could see she was getting closer to a very uncomfortable truth. The connection with Daphne's murder is starting to become clear. If people she wrote about had been, you know, had faced justice right away, there's a very good chance she would be alive today.
Corinne, take us back to October 2017 when your sister was killed.
Yeah.
How did you find out?
I was at home because I work from home. My nephew called me and said, "You have to come now. There was a bomb in mommy's car." And that hasn't stopped since then. We've been fighting for justice ever since.
The new developments in the investigation, you said earlier that they're long overdue. How active was the government in 2017 in pursuing an investigation? What did you see?
But, you know, the only movement in the case was the arrest of three men in December 2017. And against the odds, the magisterial inquiry that was going on was kept open. But the length of time it took to move from that point to where we are today suggests that there had been direct political interference in the investigation. But if there was interference, then we can already guess at where that was coming from and why it was happening, given that the Prime Minister's chief of staff is now a murder suspect.
Are you making the assumption that these officials in Malta would not be stepping down if they were not implicated in her death?
It's not an assumption. Their reasons for stepping down are reasons only they can explain, but they are very definitely implicated.
Your sister dedicated her career to uncovering corruption. Since her death, what has changed in Malta in the corruption area?
Well, it is an amazing thing that people have continued covering the subject. You know, given that Daphne was killed, it must have been a very, very big step for people to continue her work. The other change that has happened is that there's a louder civil society. Malta does not have a tradition of public protest, of people taking to the streets, you know, groups organizing themselves. All of that happened as a direct result of Daphne's murder. And now we are seeing changes at the political level as well. People are finally beginning to realize that what Daphne was writing wasn't partisan. It was truth and it was factual.
So that's in Malta. The rest of the world, though, I mean, the Panama Papers was a massive data leak, one of the biggest ever in history. And then it seemed to slip out of the headlines. I mean, there was a Netflix feature movie and a documentary. But do you feel that the rest of the world has kind of moved on from this big story about offshore accounts and billionaires hiding their assets from the tax collectors?
It's hard to predict what will happen from here on. But, you know, you can't argue with murder. But we do know that there have been movements in other countries. People have resigned. People have been forced out of office. There have been all of those changes. None of those changes have happened in Malta. The first direct change is Szkembri's resignation yesterday, and Mitzi's soon followed afterwards. Those are the two men in the Panama Papers who should have resigned 3 years ago. What will happen from here on? It's really hard to tell.
Corinne Vella, the sister of Daphne Caruana Galizia, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for calling.
In Germany, the growing success of the far-right AfD party has upended the political landscape there. The AfD has also been taking aim at publicly funded theaters and art institutions. The World's Orla Barry has this report from Berlin.
Bernd Schmidt is one of Berlin's best-known theater directors. He runs the Friedrichstadt Palast, and he knows what it's like to get on the wrong side of the AfD. After the party's success in national elections in 2017, the first time a far-right party gained a seat in parliament in over six decades, Schmidt wrote an email to his staff. Many of them are from outside Germany, and he told them not to feel intimidated.
I have white skin and I'm born German. So I was writing an email to my cast expressing that we stand behind the artists and people working for the Palast who have dark skin, who don't look German.
Schmidt also implied that he didn't want AfD supporters or their money in his theatre.
The email became public and then we had the perfect storm.
The Berlin director received hundreds of messages of hate, but it was the AfD's public response that shocked him the most.
They said what I'm doing is similar to what the Jews were experiencing in the Third Reich. And I thought, wow. There's no discussion about sending AfD voters to concentration camps. And, you know, to compare with the Jewish people in the Third Reich shows what really dark spirit is in that party.
A week later, Schmidt's theatre got a bomb threat.
And we had to evacuate the house with 1,600 guests and 200 artists.
The threat turned out to be a hoax, but it was a warning to other theatres in Germany that taking on the AfD could have ugly consequences. Hugh Bronson is a Berlin lawmaker with the AfD who spent years living in Britain. Bronson dismisses suggestions that his party wants to censor artists or art institutions.
Our stance is not much different from stances of other parties, only that we want to be more careful with funding, with taxpayers' money to be spent for arts projects. We're not against any type of art as long as people are interested, as long as artists are free to express themselves. It's all fine by us.
I asked Bronson about his party's attack on Bernd Schmidt and the subsequent bomb threat.
You always have some loonies who use any opportunity to let go of their anger. It has nothing to do with our party. We don't tolerate such behaviour and we don't encourage this. It's everyone's right to give a political statement, even though as a director of a theatre, you should be more careful about what you say.
Theatre is heavily state-funded in Germany. And with the AfD's success in local elections, the party can now influence where that money goes. But it's not just the political leanings of theatre productions the AfD may be looking to alter. Berlin-based writer Paul Hockenus says the party is also looking to change Germany's relationship with its past. I meet him in a cafe in East Berlin.
The way that Germans think about the past, there's also something called the culture of memory, which includes monuments and exhibitions and museums, but also school textbooks and things like that. And this is another area where the far right feels that they have unjustly lost, that Germans are far too critical of themselves for the role that Germany played in the Second World War and the Holocaust. So they're also fighting a cultural battle.
Hockenus doesn't believe that artists and performers are being targeted by the AfD, but he says the threat from the far right is real.
We've had violent attacks on leading politicians, on synagogues, on people on the street who are Jewish or foreigners, leftists. So what the AfD has done is they've basically opened the way for extremists to take it all a step further with violence. This is a real threat now in Germany that didn't exist before.
Artist Thomas Schließer thinks the threat existed long before the AfD came to power. He began working on art projects targeting far-right rhetoric back in 2007. Then Schließer himself became a target.
And one moment I found on the internet my name on a website, Braunbuch der Volksverräter. I can't translate that.
The words effectively mean a traitor to the people. Schließer's address and phone number were also listed.
And I was pretty scared because they said, everybody, when we take over, we're going to catch these guys and put them in camps and you know what happens.
Schließer has gone on to organise rallies against the AfD. I ask him if the intimidation made him more cautious.
Not at all. I think I even got more active. Okay, I'm very a little bit more hesitant to give my phone number and private address, I must say. But on the other hand, if people want to go for you, they're going to find you.
The director, Bernd Schmidt, also refuses to stay quiet. He's particularly troubled by one recent incident in Stuttgart, where the AfD asked for a list of the nationalities of all the performers at the city's opera house.
You know, doing lists in Germany, I think you get goosebumps because you are remembered on the Third Reich. Yeah? Lists of Jewish people and Jewish shops. So if a party like this asks a theatre, give me a list how many of your employees have a foreign background, this raises very bad memories.
Schmidt says he was even more upset when local officials complied with the request.
And this was for me the biggest shock. Yeah? You should not do it.
Why do they give the list to them?
I don't know. Maybe they didn't read the history books or maybe they thought about the money, but, you know, sometimes money stinks.
Increasing popularity at the polls may give the AfD a greater say in who gets state funding and could influence just how outspoken theatres will be in the future if they want to survive. For The World, Orla Barry, Berlin.
We all have our Thanksgiving traditions, family, food, frenzied travel. Here at The World, we are also thinking about the 250,000 Americans serving overseas, who tomorrow will also be marking Thanksgiving. We're talking members of the U.S. military as well as Defense Department civilians across the globe. We reached out to veterans and asked them to share some memories of Thanksgiving deployments.
My name is Sergeant Ron Huff, and I live in Brownsville, Texas.
Sergeant Huff recalled his mission to Qatar in 2002.
I was at this Air Force base for a mission, and I remember eating Thanksgiving dinner that year. It struck me that the Air Force officers, they waited in line with us and sat with us and spoke with us plainly. That's something that never happens in the Army. I saw some of the biggest prepared turkeys I'd ever seen in my life, and I was able to eat as much as I wanted. And the Air Force base commander gave a speech, and I felt really happy to be treated to this amazing, extravagant meal. And I wrote home and let my parents know to not feel bad for me that day.
More memories from Sergeant Huff about a second Thanksgiving deployment in Baghdad later in the show, and other recollections from Thanksgivings while deployed abroad. A quick note before we get back to the show. We're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we have the opportunity to receive $20,000 in matching funds to support our reporting. But we need you to join us and support the world to get those matching dollars. Your gift today will go so much further. It means double the support for our unparalleled coverage of issues like immigration, the environment, global security, and human rights. Reporting that you can't find pulled together in a single place anywhere else. Make a contribution today to support the global journalism you rely on. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift. The Trump administration cannot confirm how many families were separated at the U.S. southern border last year. Those are the findings of a new government report from the Office of the Inspector General. The report shows that the Department of Homeland Security lacked the ability to track all the children and adults who were separated during a six-week period during the zero-tolerance policy, and DHS officials knew they would not be able to keep track of the separations. But the agency did not address the problem for months. This new report builds on mounting lawsuits and concerns over the treatment of families. Lee Gallant is a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union. He is lead on a class action suit representing children separated from their families.
It confirms what we've learned through the litigation, that there was no tracking system, that they took little kids away from their parents, sent them across the country, and didn't bother to keep track of who they had separated. But I think one really revealing fact from the report that's new is that during a pilot program, they realized that they didn't have a tracking system in place. Yet instead of stopping the family separation program, they ramped it up into what became known as zero tolerance practice and started doing it to thousands of children, knowing that they didn't have a system to track. And I think the report highlights that point, and that's a critical new piece of information.
Why was there not a tracking system in place when they started this policy?
Well, I think that's, you know, the right question. I think some of it is just sort of deliberate cruelty, perhaps. Some of it could have just been incompetence.
When did DHS realize the problems they had on their hands, and what did they do about it when they did?
We are still working with DHS, to be honest, to try and get a tracking system in place. You know, we have not really been satisfied with what we know about the tracking system at this point or what information they're sharing.
So this was all happening during a six-week period last year under the government's zero-tolerance policy, as you said. Just remind us, what is that policy?
So zero-tolerance was the name they gave to the policy of systematically separating parents and children. What they said is they're going to start prosecuting every parent and taking the child away from the parent during the prosecution. It's the period where they ramped up family separations. But truthfully, what we've now learned, particularly in the last few weeks, is that the separation started well before that six-week period and still is ongoing.
So the report documented that the Immigration Inspections Program provided the Office of Management and Budget with estimates of 26,000 children that could be separated from their families because of the zero-tolerance policy. So how many kids were in fact separated?
So our latest numbers show approximately 5,500 that were separated. You know, we hope that that doesn't end up being a larger number, but this new figure that the report is releasing, that is shocking. And without the public outcry and without the court case, maybe it would have ended up being 26,000. This is really remarkable new information.
And how many children are in custody?
Hundreds, at least. But the government has not been providing timely, meaningful information. So we do not actually know how many children are sitting all by themselves in government custody at this moment.
So if you estimated 5,500 children separated from their families. Where are they now?
We have gotten thousands of them reunited with their parents. Other families, we are still looking all over the world for the parent to see whether they've been reunited and whether they need help getting reunited. Others are in government custody. It's just a mess. We thought after the court's order in June of 2018, everything would be put to an end. And unfortunately, we're still talking about this, getting new information about what the government has done. And the program is still ongoing with more than 1,100 children having been separated since the court told the government to stop. This is really just one of these tragic, tragic moments in our country's history, I think.
Lee Gallant is a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's now turn to Paris, where about 1,000 tractors are gumming up roads and highways. That includes the Champs-Élysées. French farmers from across the country are driving to the capital to protest the government's agricultural policies. Two French farm unions are calling on President Emmanuel Macron to meet with them. They have some grievances over his recent policies on agriculture. One farmer taking part in the demonstration is Victor Rabier. He says agricultural workers need more support from their government. Rabier says today's actions are a cry for help from farmers who feel forgotten, not only by the French government, but by Europe, too. Rabier says it's time to put a stop to agro-bashing, or agri-bashing in French. They say they get criticized over their use of pesticides. They face accusations that they mistreat livestock. And they're also angry with Paris for banning a common weed killer, which will be phased out by 2021. The government has offered up no alternative. That's angering farmers who say pulling out weeds manually is not a realistic plan B. Another local union leader on the Champs-Élysées is Jean-Yves Bricout. He says farmers need the government to defend their livelihoods. Bricout says that the profession of farming has been bad-mouthed and badly treated. He says certain associations criticize farmers for not doing the job the way they should and claiming that farmers are poisoning people. Paris isn't the only European city filled with tractors this week. Dublin and Berlin saw similar protests. Irish and German farmers are also demanding better wages and government support. Working during Thanksgiving can be a drag, but at least you can go to home at the end of the shift. For members of the American military and their family, the sacrifices made during the holidays can be especially tough. But as Sergeant Ron Huff of Brownsville, Texas, remembers, there's an extra effort to make the holidays special for soldiers on deployment.
On a mission in Baghdad in 2005, I had Thanksgiving dinner at Saddam Hussein's Baghdad Palace in the Green Zone. It was pretty awesome. This was the center of operations for the State Department and the coalition forces. And there were ice sculptures and chefs in tall hats. There were meats of all kinds. It was like eating at the Golden Corral. There's so many selections. They had at least 5 different kinds of desserts. In the Green Zone, you hardly ever see children. I was surprised when I saw a Caucasian boy picking up a dessert. It looked like he was in elementary school. I asked him where he was from, and he said his mother worked for the State Department and that he had been flown in to spend the holiday with her. So I was pretty shocked that they could have their small child flown into a war zone for the holiday.
More holiday memories from vets ahead this hour, including a soldier who tells us about eating 2 massive Thanksgiving dinners in one day.
I can't believe we ate it, but yeah, I mean, I guess when you're burning 6,000 calories a day, go up and down mountains and whatnot, it's kind of no big deal.
This is the world. Chinese communist leaders are enjoying our impeachment spectacle. Their message? America is tearing itself apart.
But look at our system, a system where the Chinese Communist Party is leading in all areas of economic, political, and social life. And we have a stable system.
Impeachment, the view from China, that's coming up here on The World. Many of us were glued to our screens for the impeachment proceedings. Governments across the world have also been watching. In China, you might say they're loving the spectacle. Here's The World's Patrick Nguyen.
The Chinese government wants to tell its people and the world a story. The gist of the story is democracy, the kind you see in America, what a mess. Over and over, they say,
look at the United States. Look at the inequality. Look at the problems with racial relations. Look at the politics.
That is Adam Ni, a visiting fellow at National Chung-Chi University in Taiwan. He says the impeachment scandal is making it easier to tell this story, because when you do look at the politics, it is messy. Even the American president thinks so.
And nobody's seen anything like it. In the history of our country, there has never been a disgrace like what's going on right now.
That is Trump earlier this month talking about the impeachment hearings in Congress. Now, impeachment is something you'd never see in China, where President Xi Jinping reigns supreme, and there is no opposition party. The People's Republic of China is a one-party state and always has been. Adam Ni says China's message is, look, America, with its political divisions, is tearing itself apart.
But look at our system, a system where the Chinese Communist Party is leading in all areas of economic, political, and social life, and we have a stable system.
So that's how the Chinese Communist Party wants the world to see Trump's impeachment woes. It's all about Trump's flaws and U.S. disorder. But how do they talk about it behind closed doors?
They really do view the Trump challenge to China as possibly the most serious challenge in the post-Cold War period.
That's Nicholas Koo, professor at Otago University in New Zealand. And yeah, Trump can certainly sound like a threat.
Because we can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
Koo says that internally, the Communist Party really does worry that Trump's trade war will hurt China's economy. And that touches on the basic pact the Communist Party has with its citizens. We get power and control, and your life will keep getting better, materially speaking. So if Trump can disturb that pact,
that will affect, in the Chinese view, how China rises and certainly the rate at which it rises.
Okay, so that settles it. Obviously, the Chinese Communist Party would clearly want Trump to get impeached, right? Well, maybe not.
Ultimately, Beijing will be sad to see Trump go because Trump is undermining U.S. power internationally and dividing the U.S. internally.
Once again, that's Adam Ni. Short term, yes, he says, Trump is a headache for China's leaders.
But over the long term, I think they would want to see Trump win in 2020.
Yep, he says, next year, the Politburo will be rooting for the Donald, in the most cynical way. Because a new president, Ni says, may divide Americans less and may finally pull together a coherent plan to slow the rise of China. And yes, that person may be a Democrat. Professor Koo says Beijing is realizing that American anger towards China is not just going to vanish with Donald Trump.
Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, the view in Washington, D.C. at this point in time is to actually take a rather hard line against the Chinese.
And here is a case in point.
The Senate has just sent a resounding message to the Chinese Communist Party and President Xi.
Top Democrat Chuck Schumer.
That the United States stands with the democratic protesters in Hong Kong.
He's talking about a bill that just passed supporting Hong Kong protesters' fight against Communist Party domination of their territory, which is a part of China. Now, practically everyone in U.S. politics supports this bill, from Ted Cruz to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So, more and more, when it comes to China, Professor Koo says, and this is not a sentence you hear very often.
If you look at the Democratic Party and Trump, there's not much difference of opinion.
At least he says that's the view from Beijing. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
President Trump has other things on his mind besides the impeachment, like stopping Mexican drug cartels by designating them foreign terrorist organizations. Trump made the announcement in an interview with former Fox News host Bill O'Reilly.
It is a very, very sad situation.
So you are going to designate the...
Something's going to have to do.
You're going to designate the Mexican cartels as terror groups?
I am going to be designating the cartels. Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
That'll be a big story.
I've been working on that for the last 90 days. You know, designation is not that easy.
No, I know.
You have to go through a process, and we're well into that process. And
A formal designation would make it illegal to knowingly provide material support to the cartels. It could make travel harder for cartel members and prevent them from accessing banks. Arturo Sarucan is a former Mexican ambassador to the United States. What is your reaction to this?
Well, I think it's the wrong policy and it's the wrong toolbox, because despite how violent organized crime may be in Mexico or elsewhere, there are important differences. Organized crime does not want to destroy the state. They need a weak but functioning state to be able to conduct their illicit business. And one could even argue, Marco, that if you're going to designate Mexican drug organizations as foreign terrorist organizations, one could argue that then U.S. consumers of illicit drugs and U.S. gun shops on the U.S. side of the border are accomplices to foreign terrorist organizations. 70% of the weapons seized in Mexico can be traced back to a U.S. gun shop. And it's the money and the revenue from consumption in the U.S. that is feeding their ability to confront and weaken the state. So this is an easy recipe which won't move the needle structurally in Mexico, and which unfortunately provides President Trump with more elements to his narrative of Mexico as a national security threat to the United States as he seeks re-election in 2020.
Well, in his interview with Bill O'Reilly, Trump offered this justification for his action.
Look, we're losing 100,000 people a year to what's happening and what's coming through on Mexico.
The president's numbers, 100,000 a year dead, are way off. But a proportion of the fentanyl and heroin that Americans are using is coming through Mexico.
Yeah.
Can you understand the political imperative here for the administration to be seen to be doing more?
Absolutely. But one could argue that likewise, the Mexican government could be arguing and could be pointing to the hundreds of thousands that have been killed since Mexico started to confront organized crime with weapons that were bought or illegally trafficked across the border. This is a two-way street, Marco. This type of narrative does little to help. I agree with the president that there is an endemic crisis in the United States when it comes to opioids and fentanyl. But remember, a lot of that crisis was triggered domestically in the United States by overprescription, regardless of how organized crime has muscled its way into feeding off of that crisis.
Designation as a terrorist organization, these cartels, also raises the possibility of military action. And on that question, President Trump said he had already spoken with Mexican President López Obrador.
I've actually offered him to let us go in and clean it out, and he so far has rejected the offer. But at some point, something has to be done.
Ambassador, would Mexico consider U.S. military assistance against the cartels?
No. The Mexican government already yesterday said that this was off the table and that they would consider anything like this as a violation of Mexican sovereignty. So I don't think that's going to have legs.
O'Reilly also asked Trump if he would launch drone strikes or similar military action without Mexican approval, and Trump did not rule it out. What would happen in that case?
Then all bets are off, because it would probably scupper a relationship that has so painstakingly been built over the past two decades. This would rip asunder the military relationship that has been evolving and growing between Mexico and the United States since 9/11. And this isn't even going into, you know, violation of international law. So this would be a very, very, very delicate development.
Former Mexican ambassador to the United States, Arturo Sarucan, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Marco.
Drug cartels are becoming increasingly adept at smuggling their product. This week, a 60-foot submarine was seized off the coast of northwest Spain, inside at least 4,000 pounds of cocaine. The sub ran aground off the Galician coast, forcing the men inside to abandon it. Two Ecuadorians were arrested trying to swim ashore. Police say a third smuggler remains at large. The sub may have been the first ever that was able to make the drug smuggling journey from South America to Europe, or at least the first one that was intercepted. We've seen this before, but not on an ambitious transatlantic route. Submarines have been used to smuggle cocaine from Latin America to the U.S. The Coast Guard nabbed one back in June off the Pacific coast of South America. In a dramatic video of that seizure, a member of the Coast Guard leaps onto a partially submerged sub while it's moving and pounds on the hatch. Inside that sub, 16,000 pounds of cocaine. Question: do you know Nine Man? It's kind of like street volleyball, but with more players. The court is bigger, the pace is faster, and it started in Chinatowns across North America. Here's reporter Anna Kusmer.
21-year-old Ethan Wong has been playing nine-man since he was 13. He says his club, the Boston Hurricanes, feels like family.
I feel like I have a bunch of older brothers, but like also like younger siblings, and I feel like I should give them advice, you know?
Nine-man got its start in the city parks and alleyways of Chinatowns, but now it's also played in the suburbs, too, like here in this spacious high school gym complex in Newton, Massachusetts. One of Ethan's coaches is his dad, John Wong. John also played nine-man growing up in Boston's Chinatown.
The genesis of nine-man came from just, you know, Chinese immigrants, right, who were predominantly restaurant workers, and they needed some type of, you know, outlet when they're not working. And the sport of nine-man built a community.
John says over the years, he got a good job and moved out to the suburbs. And his sons didn't have easy access to the tight-knit Chinese-American community he grew up with. He says playing nine-man is a place for them to connect with their roots. Just about everyone playing here today has roots in China. It's no coincidence, says Boston Hurricanes president Jeff Chin. It's the rules.
The rules to be eligible is that you have to have some Asian or pan-Asian heritage. And then on the court, the rule is that six out of the nine should be 100% Chinese.
The other three players can be half Chinese or have a background from another East Asian country. These rules are for the big annual tournaments, like the North American Chinese Invitational Volleyball Tournament played on Labor Day weekends. Thousands of players come from Chinese-American communities in Boston, New York, Toronto, Montreal, San Francisco, and a dozen other places. Chin says keeping the sport all Asian gives kids a unique experience.
First, they're a little shocked, and then they feel safe as far as, okay, this, I don't feel like the minority.
And when you're almost always a minority, that feeling can be pretty powerful. Ursula Leung made a 2014 documentary about Nine Man.
It's not an entirely race-exclusive space, but it is a space that's trying to honor opportunity for Chinese Americans and the opportunity to be like free of stereotype, but also the opportunity to play, which for Chinese Americans is a very specific opportunity because there's still very strong stereotypes about the abilities of Asian American bodies.
Stereotypes, she says, like they don't have athletic builds, they're not assertive.
One of the great things about Nine Man is that it's sort of, I think it wants to defy the stereotypes so badly that it really is a counter narrative, and it's encouraged, you know, and celebrated that to be like loud and crazy and hyper out of the, you know, out of any kind of box that they could put you in.
Cameron Ponce plays with the Boston Hurricanes. He is Filipino-American, one of the three non-Chinese players allowed on the court during the tournament. He says he doesn't mind the rules.
I think it's cool that they let three non-full Chinese people play in general. So, I totally get it.
In fact, Ponce says he feels more included here than when he plays on mostly white volleyball teams.
If anything, I felt more outside than that because like I was more Asian.
But there is a conversation going on about whether the rules need to evolve. Jeff Chin wants Nine Man to remain Asian, but he says as demographics change, there may be fewer 100% ethnic Chinese players interested in the sport.
You know, what happens in, you know, 20, 30 years from now when there's more mixed kids, and that's naturally going to happen. You know, how does that play into the rules and how do you adjust rules to facilitate for that?
The bigger conversation may be about opening Nine Man to another group, women and girls.
I think that'd be super fun.
Amanda Lacey plays volleyball with the Hurricanes, but she'd like to get the chance to play in Nine Man tournaments.
Like, to prove that, like, we can do it too. Like, not just the guys. We can do it too.
For The World, Anna Kusmer, Newton, Massachusetts.
If you want a good understanding of how the economy is doing, look at birth rates. Fertility rates drop during hard times, then bounce back when things pick up. That's what happened in the years after the Great Depression in the 1930s, but that is not what happened after the Great Recession that began in 2007. Last year, fertility rates in the U.S. hit an all-time low. That's according to a new report from the National Center for Health Statistics. William Fry is a senior demographer at the Brookings Institution. Fertility rates in the U.S. hit a record low in 2018. Why is that?
Yeah, it's gone down 4 years in a row and gone down substantially since 2007. And there are actually women in their early 30s are having more kids than women in their late 20s. So this tells you that there's a pushing back of having fertility. Some other countries have shown even bigger declines in their fertility. And the U.S. still is actually in pretty good shape in terms of what's called the total fertility rate, which is the average number of children that women have over the course of their reproductive years. If it's at 2.1, it means the population is replacing itself. The U.S. is about 1.7. In Europe, it's about 1.5, and in Eastern Europe, it's about 1.3. Those countries are in real trouble, I think, in terms of being able to take care of their aging population because they're having fewer people going into the labor force than are aging out of the labor force.
How long is it until the U.S. sees those same impacts? Where are we at right now?
Well, I don't know if we're going to hit those kinds of levels that we see in Japan or Italy or Spain or Romania down at the 1.3 or 1.4 total fertility rate level. And the reason I say that is because we have a somewhat younger age structure in our population due to the immigration that we've had over the last three or four decades, reasonably high immigration. It's not that immigrants have lots more children than the native-born population, but because they make the population younger and there are more women in those childbearing ages, that helps to increase our population gain.
William, as you pointed out earlier, people in the U.S. are having children later in life. And the report says the only age groups that recorded increases in fertility rates are women in their late 30s and early 40s. It's also happening in Europe. So what is happening here? Do you see similar patterns on two continents?
Yeah, I think there are some things going on that are in some ways better for women in some European countries because women in some Scandinavian countries and Western European countries benefit from government programs which provide them with government-subsidized childcare, paid family leave, and this sort of thing. While it doesn't make their fertility higher, it allows women who do have children to have them more easily and to keep them in the labor force. If we think of the United States compared to European countries or Japan, we're not aging quite as rapidly as they are. And even though we have this lower fertility, we're younger and we're more vibrant in some ways. And we do have an immigration to this country that's at levels which if we keep them and try to take care of those immigrants and their children, I think we're going to be in pretty good shape because you need these young, vibrant people moving into the labor force. And that means that sort of young immigrant children and second and third generation Americans are going to make us somewhat more vibrant, I think, than other countries which are aging much more rapidly than we are.
William Fry is a senior fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Thanks very much for being with us, William.
Sure. Good to be with you.
Here's the thing about holidays like Thanksgiving. When you spend them abroad, you have to work harder to make the day feel like back home. We've been hearing stories today from military veterans who spent Thanksgivings deployed around the world. Here's U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Brandon Davis of San Mateo, California. He served with a civil affairs detachment in the second invasion of Iraq.
In November of 2004, while deployed in northern Iraq, I was in the Kurdish region living amongst the Kurds in the area of Duhok. And the small team of Americans I was with, we were so far away from any other Americans in the area. So we really kind of fend for ourselves a lot of times. And as we approached Thanksgiving, we had made plans for having some kind of meal together, along with our Kurdish bodyguards and support staff, getting things like canned cranberries and stuffing mix and things like that was pretty straightforward. Everyone was asking friends and family to send it to the APO, which is the Army Post Office, that would get to us. It wouldn't actually get to us directly, though. We'd have to brave going down pretty deep into Mosul to the southern part of the city, which was pretty dangerous. And I remember throughout October and into November, we started having a pile of stuff near our kitchen, assembling everything we needed for the Thanksgiving meal. The one thing we were missing was turkeys, but throughout our daily missions, going to these small towns in the mountains and whatnot, we all started to notice that in this one particular town near the Turkish border, north of an area called Zawita, we were among these stone and mud huts, and I saw these two turkeys, and Basically, I kind of commented about it to our interpreter. I said, you know, hey, Haitham, you know, we have this thing called Thanksgiving, and it's this big celebration. It's a meal. It's kind of on the scale of one of the Ramadan meals. We have all the ingredients we need. We just need turkeys. Is there a way that we can buy a couple turkeys from, you know, the locals here? And he said, oh, I'll go talk to him. Within a few minutes, we heard a couple gunshots, and we freaked out for a split second. And then the Peshmerga guards just come walking over with these two turkeys they shot. They're like, here you go. So the next day, we planned to make a meal, and we were in the process of making it all when the person on radio watch said, hey, there's two Blackhawks flying into the Peshmerga compound in the southern part of the city. You need to go pick it up. There's a general coming. We're like, what? To see us? That was only a handful of us. Oh, yeah, yeah. He's bringing Thanksgiving meal in these containers that are sealed to, you know, keep the heat and whatnot. And so, yeah, we went with the Pesh down to the Famunda compound, and these two Blackhawks came in, and this general who was in command of the northern part of the region comes out, and he brings this prepared meal for us. So we ate Thanksgiving with our Kurdish allies, and we spent a lot of time talking with the general and his staff, and lots of pictures and handshakes. And then we sent them on their way a few hours later. And then we got back to our compound, and we're like, well, we have this other meal. So we prepared that, and I can't believe we ate it. But yeah, I mean, I guess when you're burning 6,000 calories a day, go up and down mountains and whatnot, it's kind of no big deal. But honestly, with food, you miss things being in places far away like that. You get used to local foods, but there's something about those traditional meals that give you a little taste of home that is good for the soul.
Mm-hmm. Staff Sergeant Brandon Davis, remembering Thanksgiving 15 years ago in northern Iraq. Davis told us after the second dinner that day, they played pickup football and taught the rules to local kids. That's where our thoughts go today. A big thanks to all the service members who share their Thanksgiving memories with us, as well as to those who are eating their turkey dinners far away from home this year. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.